All right, we are going to call this committee to order. This is the Transportation and Public Safety Committee meeting of Monday, March 2nd, 2015. Members, we have five items on the agenda. We're going to be starting with the confirmation hearing for the Department of Transportation Commissioner Charles Zelli. And then we're going to move quickly from that to finish the unfinished business from last week, Senate File 86. And stay tuned on Senate Files 1046 and 1047. They may or may not come up. We'll see. There's some last-minute concerns that cropped up, and Senator Carlson is in his office now trying to resolve those. Commissioner Zelli, please come to the table. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed as you see fit. We have the materials from the appointment documents in front of us.
Yes. Well, if I may, Mr. Chair and Senators, I'll kind of maybe give a 10-minute overview just very briefly about my background, which is clearly given in my resume, but also maybe more time as to what I see are some highlights over the past 2 years. But first off, it is a great honor and my great privilege to be having served as Commissioner of Department of Transportation for a little over 2 years, and to serve not just the governor, but obviously the people of Minnesota, and an agency which, to my delight, are the most wonderful collection of professionals that I am learning from on a daily basis. So I'm looking forward to continuing to work in that department and continuing a lot of its great work. As you can see from my resume, prior to coming to the Department of Transportation, I've had a deep background in transportation, both operations, managing Jefferson Lines, but also a number of positions in transportation policy. I actually am not a stranger to MnDOT. I served on the committee, the very now famous Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, but even before that, I served on the Minnesota GO, which was a 50-year visioning process for what people, the citizens of Minnesota, expect or want when they think of transportation. I was one of the founding members of the Itasca Project and served almost for 10 years as the co-chair of its transportation initiative, and then served as chair of the Minneapolis Regional Chamber of Commerce, where transportation was and may still be one of its leading initiatives and goals. I served on the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies and was their director, chairman of their finance committee. And I think I finally understand a little bit how the University of Minnesota does its accounting. With regard to Jefferson Lines, I actually did have a background to develop networks of intercity carriers with rural transportation providers and urban transit throughout 13-state area. In that regard, I remind this committee when I came before 2 years ago that I do kind of acknowledge and disclose any potential conflict that I have with Jefferson Lines. I still is a family business, and I serve as chair of the board. I am not actively engaged in the management any longer. In the past filed, and I still have a memorandum that clearly articulates where I would recuse myself if any situation occurred, both at MnDOT or as chair of Jefferson Lines, should any conflict situation present itself. I'm pleased to say that that has not been an issue in the past 2 years, and I've never had to formally recuse myself because the issue has never come up. But I think it's really important to go beyond what the law requires, and so I have that procedure in place, and all the top people and general chief counsel at MnDOT and the governor's office understand how I would handle that if there were ever any conflict would present itself. I could put the MnDOT highlights over the past 2 years in kind of six-month sections. The first 6 months, being new to the job, I kind of got to know the agency, got to know the work on all of its products and services. And I early developed what I would say a little bit more enhanced communications philosophy, that we want to speak more openly about what is happening, how the agency prioritizes projects, what it does. And for that regard, I started traveling and speaking and listening. I spoke specifically about a lot of the recommendations of the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, because I'd just been coming out of that context. Early on, there was some issues I dealt with very quickly, particularly some areas of concern within the Office of Civil Rights. I did make a unilateral change in restructuring both who was the management of that office and where it actually was placed within the MnDOT organization. The director of who was then interim and now is the full director, Kim Collins, who reports to Betsy Parker, the chief counsel, and has a dotted line to me. I've been in close relationships with that office ever since, and I'm really pleased with the progress it has made since that time. At that first six-month period, we adopted a new vision, a new mission, and new values for MnDOT. The vision is not, I forget exactly what it was, about innovation and being a global leader, but we actually lifted the vision that came from the Minnesota GO process. It is what Minnesotans themselves seek or want when you think of transportation, and that is to have a multimodal transportation system that maximizes the health of people, the environment, and our economy. And in the shorthand version is, our purpose at MnDOT is not to serve MnDOT. It is MnDOT that serves the people of Minnesota. So we are really a tool toward economic prosperity, toward livability, toward what we need to be in terms of competitiveness. And I think that is something I speak and did speak a lot about internally within the agency and going forward. Early on, we started this leadership group within MnDOT, started rethinking how we make decisions. That was came to me on a Tuesday morning when one of our division directors, head of engineering, said, geez, you know, we're pretty world-class on building bridges, and we're pretty world-class on understanding concrete viscosity, but maybe we're not so world-class in how we manage ourselves. And that was music to my ears, because I felt strongly that we could improve how MnDOT is managed. And we ended up in a full retreat with the Carlson School of Management to think about our decision-making process and actually incorporated a new model, really to push down decisions within the organization to the experts who really have the best knowledge about and expertise to make decisions, and leaving more strategy and more ways to assess accountability and to direct resources at the higher level. At the end of 6 months, I restructured the management organization within MnDOT. Initially, it was commissioner, deputy commissioner, and about 17 people reporting to the deputy commissioner. Now I'm very fortunate to spend 6 months and getting to know some wonderful people within the organization, and recruited back to the central office Tracy Hatch as a deputy commissioner and chief financial officer, very, very smart and very capable in terms of helping this cadence of accountability that she brings to run operations. Also, our chief engineer, we're one of the few states that has a woman to be our chief engineer, but Sue Mulvihill has decades of experience, has done almost every job. And my quick little view of Sue Mulvihill is, in the first 6 months, when you think about a formal structure, and then I was really looking for, what's the informal structure? Where do people go? Who do they go to when they want to solve a problem and understand what's really going on? And I noticed more and more people go into Sue Mulvihill's office to kind of have that conversation. And so I found myself going to Sue Mulvihill's office and saying, maybe she could help make this a more formal structure. So those two deputy commissioners are really the foundation of our day-to-day operations. I elevated a chief of staff in Eric Davis to manage both our external and work with me on developing some of the initiatives that are really important, I think, for the state and for the agency. The chief counsel reports directly to me. And then most recently, we've initiated a new position of an assistant commissioner for policy in Sean Ron, who has also joined our kind of executive team. So we have five people reporting to me, and I think we have much better governance and efficiency in how we manage the agency. During the next 12 months, we started thinking about all the goals, initiatives, task forces, I think we called them flagships, that the agency was pursuing. All of them very important, but it was thought that, and collectively I think we thought, how can we actually make progress on as many as 200 different initiatives? So we boiled it down to one. So we have one overriding goal over the past 18 months, and that has been to enhance our financial effectiveness. It has become a very clear guiding principle for every employee within the agency. In fact, we have weekly meetings where every department sets goals for what they're doing on a particular week. And we have three main areas. One is how we scope and manage projects, how we measure and manage our assets, and the third is how we actually do our financial measures, how we can actually have a fully allocated cost of our products and services. So not to say that MnDOT is a business, but there's no reason we can't be managed with the kind of prudence that any large organization that manages large-scale projects and large-scale systems should be doing. We then, a very important initiative was advancing and implementing the Corridors of Commerce. Corridors of Commerce, as we all know, is a very robust program to develop strategic capacity improvements throughout the state. And part of that was to show what we could do, but also to really use through bonding and efficiency ways to advance key capacity projects through interregional corridors that otherwise wouldn't have been part of our normal investment plan. And I think they've been measured with some success. In the most recent round of financing and Corridors of Commerce, we've really developed the capacity to do additional work in future years if and when funding is available. We also initiated an information and outreach campaign that was really not just myself, but I did most of it, which was visiting communities throughout the state of Minnesota, meeting with chambers of commerce, meeting with rotaries, meeting with at town hall meetings, and actually talking about what is the impact transportation is in various communities, listening to what citizens are saying. And so I've lost the number after about 80 visits, but this has been an ongoing effort to almost every week have some way to both speak about what transportation means, a multimodal system for the state of Minnesota, but also to listen to others as to what their needs and what their beliefs and what their thinking is. Another highlight I'm very proud of is elevating our diversity and inclusion efforts. We actually reformed a diversity and inclusion executive council. There's been a lot of good work within MnDOT, but when we kind of started taking a look at it, you realize we have the Office of Civil Rights, we have Affirmative Action, we have Human Resources, we have it in various parts of the agency. And so to develop an overall philosophy within the agency, we have actually formed all the top leaders within the agency are part of the Diversity and Inclusion Council. We meet every month for a couple hours. We have actually personally done our own IDI assessment about how we can might enhance our own personal cultural competency. So we're holding each other accountable to measures and knowing that if we're going to change a culture to make it more welcoming, both to attract but also to retain people with differences. We have to use and set a tone at the top of the organization. And we're also working very closely with employee resource groups to help inform and roll out what we think is not just a nice thing, it is essential for our future, both to have our future employees and to be able to manage and interact with the constituencies throughout the state of Minnesota. So that is in very congruent with the governor's Diversity and Inclusion Council, which I also sit on, but this is what we're doing within the agency. I personally have joined a group that Itasca project has set up with Brad Hewitt, the CEO of Thrivent, and Mekong Hung, the CEO of Wilder Foundation, to have a separate group of about 10 CEOs, and I'll be one of those, to meet regularly to hold each other accountable to what we're doing within our own organizations. And I think I'm very committed, and I think we have a long way to go, but I think there's progress. MnDOT took a special interest and helped develop all the tribal training curriculums. So I've been a large part of advancing some of the work that we're doing in executing the governor's executive order to have government-to-government relationships with all the tribes. So MnDOT has developed the training for all agencies. So I've been part of that initial work and continue to be part of the tribal training sessions, and then have now personally visited every tribe and had a government-to-government protocol. So I actually think we're helping develop a much closer relationships with many of the tribes. And when they think about how that affects transportation and the surrounding areas, it's critical, but it's critical in so many other ways as well. So I really am very proud that MnDOT was able to be in the position to help advance that work. Also, a few other highlights, have worked with outside experts in measuring the return on investment for transportation investments, actually using some very similar methodology that I used in working through a transit build-out with the Itasca project. And there are actual measurable economic returns from transportation investments. We just needed to put together a framework to look at what those were. We also did a second round to look at the economic impacts of livability measures, what bicycle pedestrian health impacts mean to communities with transportation investments, to take a broader lens of what we do rather than just congestion, which is all about vehicle speed, and safety, which is about reducing casualties, which we do a wonderful job and are continuing to do. But this way it gives a fuller picture as to how we can invest well and not make it frivolous, make it central. I've participated in a number of multi-agency activities, the Environmental Quality Board, the Ending Homelessness Council, First Stop, which is part of DEED Economic Development Initiatives, and then the Olmsted Group. I'm actually co-chair of a Great Lakes Maritime Task Force with a number of about 8 states. Why they got the bus guy to be a maritime expert, I have no idea. But along with an official from the province of Ontario, he and I are chairing up a group to look through ways to develop a more efficient maritime system through the St. Lawrence Seaway. And I think for us in Minnesota, the Port of Duluth could be and will be a huge economic factor. So it suddenly now interests me a great deal that when we think more and more about freight capacity, both rail and the intermodal nature of that, that water continues to be a big part of our future. And it's actually a privilege to work a little along with John Linkstein and Kathleen Mosbacher, because there's both tourism and water quality issues with that Great Lake region as well. We have many multimodal plans. I won't go into all of them, but we're not just a highway department. It's been really gratifying to be involved in the planning process for ports, as I mentioned, but freight rail, bicycle. We're the second state that has a statewide pedestrian plan. And so I think how all these different modes interact with each other and support each other is kind of an important part of what we are focusing on. At MnDOT, and I'll just finish with just a couple of quick things about where we are now. I clearly am spending a lot of time talking about transportation funding. try to find the proper arithmetic behind that to be a resource for both our planning and our engineers to make that as much fact-based and not partisan approach. We are reviewing our public engagement process, that if we can spend more time working in the beginning of a project, working with our stakeholders, the community interests, we might actually be saving time and money when there's problems later on in a project when you're mitigating things that you didn't fully understand at the beginning. And so we are now reviewing how we are going to bolster our project engagement public process differently than just having public hearings. Maybe that's a model that used to work, but now we got to find people and look at ways to spend more time up front on projects. That's a big initiative going forward. We're continuing the diversity and inclusion efforts and always looking for more efficiencies. I don't at all want to not mention the values and the parts that are so central to MnDOT, our quest for innovation, our total belief that safety is our first priority, and continue to work with other agencies. I'm really proud of the efforts we've made over a number of years to bring casualties down, and the areas of integrity, accountability, and excellence. So I know I just I covered a lot of material, and I'd be very open to any comments or questions that anybody has.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions, members? Senator Peterson and Senator Reiner.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I appreciate you coming in, and I particularly appreciate your comments about your efficiencies, and which undoubtedly comes from your background in the private sector as well, and your comments about the Civil Rights Office. Both are significant areas that I know my own Senate office took a number of phone calls on, and I appreciate your willingness to take those things on and get those solved for Minnesota. And in addition to that, I appreciate your approach that I've seen and witnessed personally. You spend a lot of time in greater Minnesota, and I think, again, that has contributed a lot to your success, and hope that that continues to be a part of your calendar as you move forward. There's a couple questions that I wanted to maybe try and get on the record a little bit, because as you move forward in this process, I don't anticipate that you'll have a lot of difficulty, but some questions that will continue to come into our offices, I believe, relate specifically to the conflict of interest that you mentioned in the past, and I appreciate how you mentioned that earlier in your presentation as well to get ahead of that issue. But would you be willing to kind of go through a little bit of a kind of a step-by-step process in terms of bringing that up to date? Okay. If you'd be willing to kind of go through that, and then if you had mentioned, you'd mentioned that there has not been a conflict the last 2 years, and then would you be willing to share, the grants or the Jefferson Lines may have received from the state of Minnesota in the last 2 years or since your last nomination hearing?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you. Yes, the Jefferson Lines, going back to, I think, 2004, when Greyhound Lines left a lot of routes, Jefferson Lines came into a lot of smaller towns with the help of some federal funding under 5311F, which is a rural transit allocation for connecting cities, small towns. And so Jefferson entered into some contracts for some of those federal funds, which it does in a number of different states. So this is to partially reimburse costs. It isn't it actually isn't a isn't motivated by profits. It does help for Jefferson develop a larger network that feeds into its system. But Jefferson has had these contracts, which renew every couple of years. I believe they renewed this past. They were due to be renewed during this past 2 years. So I've disclosed that, and I do have a statement which refers to both those relationships. In addition, there often are safety oversights of commercial carriers, although the Department of Public Safety and the Federal Office of Federal Highway generally oversees what Jefferson does. So what this outlines is that I will not be part of any decision or any board discussion at Jefferson. There are other owners and other board members, so it's not something the current CEO discusses with me. And at MnDOT, it is administered by the Office of Transit, which reports to an assistant commissioner. And if there's any issues that need to go beyond that assistant commissioner, it goes directly over to the governor's office. It kind of stops at the level below those that report to me. So, and the reason I say that I haven't been presented with a conflict because I have not, nothing has, that I've heard of, has come to me. So I think that I haven't had to formally say I can't act on that. I did have one, anytime there's a Jefferson one of the companies that I've been associated with as a family member comes into a transit station or some other areas around the state, I generally disclose that, oh, by the way, that's a family business. You should know that. But I haven't been part of the process of selecting or decision-making associated with that. So that's how it's worked over the past couple of years.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, on this disclosure statement, I see that it is dated January 25th, 2013, and that's when you signed it as well. So now moving into the new legislative session of 14 and 15 and a new budget, is your position that this will continue to stay in effect indefinitely as long as you serve in as Commissioner of the Department of Transportation?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. I think this was written and signed by me to contemplate all years that I serve as commissioner beyond just the first term. It's not limited to one term, and I believe, as I remember, I would continue to abstain from appearing before MnDOT for 1 year after I serve, whenever that is.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I did get a chance to get through the 2014 of Minnesota's inner city bus study. And the question I had for you there relating to the grants or the compensation from the state of Minnesota or, as you mentioned, the federal government, you know, I see some columns there that relate to the bus routes. And there's a column that kind of addresses total revenue, and then there's a fare box ratio that's significantly less than 100%. So does that mean that the difference between the total cost of that route and the fare box ratio, that's what is coming in or being paid for by a grant from the state or federal government?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I haven't actually – it's been a few years since I've actually looked at it, and I actually haven't reviewed that report. But I know that in the past they've come in several different areas. One is to reimburse up to half. Sometimes the company would put up half the match, so it actually is still losing money. But and then there's other grants where they cover the difference between the cost, the difference between the fare box and the cost. So it depends on the grant. I'm not quite sure which ones there are, but there are both.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Commissioner, then, so I know you mentioned the federal grants, but do you know, for example, the dollar amount that Jefferson would have received in the last 2 years from the state of Minnesota? Is that zero, or is that something else?
I'm aware they continue to have grants because I know that the bus routes are still running through Minnesota, but I just don't know the
sure. Okay.
Which is a good thing, Commissioner.
Well, maybe.
That's a good thing you don't know.
Thank you.
If you had answered, I would have been worried.
It's exactly – no, I don't actually know where we're
behind. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. To follow up a little bit, another issue that I expect we're going to continue to hear about a little bit relate specifically to the compensation of the commissioners. And so I was just curious, you know, as long as we have you here on the record, when you applied for this job as Commissioner of Transportation, was the compensation an issue or a consideration for you as you were looking at this opportunity that you may have to serve the Minnesota?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I was aware of the compensation because it was pretty publicly known. It wasn't a discussion item in any of my interviews. I'm just very honored to work for this agency, and I know that I did have concern to ensure that we had people within the agency that who reported up to the agency that could be compensated to the level that we could retain them, but I had never made that approach for myself.
So, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, is it your opinion that you know, moving forward, that the governor's office, whoever may hold that in the future, will they have trouble if for whatever reason the compensation doesn't change? Will they have trouble recruiting and getting applicants for the Commissioner of Transportation?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you know, I really can't comment on that. I haven't given that much thought. I have no intention of resigning myself. I really appreciate the work and the effort I'm doing for the citizens of Minnesota, particularly as I see transportation as being a really important issue for the state now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. And I'm very encouraged to hear you say that. I certainly would be disappointed if that were the case, if you felt like you needed to leave because of that. I appreciate the time you've given here. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Chair Dibble. And Commissioner, I feel like I should come up with something more than what I had planned to say at this point. But I just wanted to, as Senator Peterson did, thank you for your commitment to getting it out into greater Minnesota. I know you've been up in northeastern Minnesota quite a bit, and I appreciate that you're coming up in April as well. And I also wanted to just comment and commend. I perked up when you started talking about serving on the organization that's looking at the Seaway, especially the port. I often think that folks in Minnesota don't know how important the Duluth Seaway Port Authority is in terms of our commerce connection to the rest of the world. And obviously in Duluth, between airport, port, freeway, and rail, I mean, we have multimodal in spades. So transportation's always been near and dear to my heart, and I appreciate the work you're doing and, you know, look forward to an ongoing relationship with you in this role. So thank you for being here today.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm really looking forward to my visit to Duluth, and actually and looking forward to talking more about what I see and what I think we can all acknowledge is the role of the port going forward. It is very much part of Minnesota's competitiveness, and when you think about the Panama Canal widening, it is an opportunity and capacity to serve the whole world, you know. Right. And there's a place we can stand near the MnDOT district headquarters where not only is Duluth multimodal, but you can see every mode from that one spot, and it's quite a tribute to the city.
Yes, thank you.
All right, anything further? Senator Carlson and Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I really have to thank you for all of the things that I've seen you do in the last few years, and I think the department has been run very well. I do have a couple of questions, though. There have been a lot of requests for efficiency improvements. We've had a lot of discussions. I've had discussions with your people about them, and we've heard of different aspects of existing projects where we've made some trade-offs, we've made some cutbacks, and then in some of those cases, the money was diverted to, let's say the funds that were saved were diverted to finishing other projects. Now, to me, that seems like it kind of muddles the idea of efficiency. And what I'd like to know is, how do you plan on identifying that particular aspect of the future job you're going to do? And you're tagging what's efficiency and what's just good reengineering, what's good public policy, what's good public input. And adding to that, I'm wondering if you're going to expand that and broaden it to the people that are actually providing services to MnDOT and asking them to show how they are going to be making their job more efficient. I'm wondering how you're going to do that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson, we've been thinking about efficiencies and economic impacts really in two ways. One is a lot of our work and effort is looking at it internally. What are we doing with taxpayer funds to be most prudent? And can we find ways to achieve 90% of a mobility with 60% of the cost? That would be we've won some awards by actually some interchanges that isn't what everybody would love, but it really suits a lot of the needs, and it, and therefore, if we save those funds, we're able to do more later. I think that there's opportunities for, and we have shown opportunities to always kind of keep a mindset that if we can find ways to deliver our service, our projects, with less dollars, but more or maybe longer life, but that's measurable. And we actually, I don't have it with me, but we have kind of a methodology that we've worked out as to how we actually measure and, in a sense, kind of book that efficiency so that we could deploy that toward projects or improvements that wouldn't otherwise be funded. So we have committed that 15% of any new revenue that comes to MnDOT, we would achieve a 15% of that amount. Part of what we think in the future efficiency can come from reconstructing pavements at a time when before they become really more expensive So we have to find a way to measure that. But sometimes that's why we think new resources can actually result in some greater efficiency. And we're willing to kind of put up that first 15% because that's a commitment that always we need to be mindful of. There's the whole way of that we're doing less good at measuring, but we're always mindful of is the external economic impacts. Sometimes we'll spend more money, and we do, on a project, to keep lanes open or to accelerate the timing of a project. When you think about the economic drag of reducing the mobility on I-35E is a good example where they work continuously around the clock, on Highway 100 where we're anticipating the complaints this summer, we will do it as fast as we can. We spend more funds. We will give bonuses to contractors. But that is an efficiency in terms of dollars, but it has great economic impact to our constituents. So we always have to say we're not going to save a lot. We could save a lot of money by just closing Highway 100 this summer, but we think that's a bad idea. So we always have to balance ways. For instance, when we rebuilt Hastings Bridge, we spent more money on aluminum and some designs to keep that 100-year bridge, not a 50-year bridge. And, frankly, building it innovatively on the side of the river and being able to float it in kept that old bridge up and running for the 2 years, which otherwise would have resulted in a 47-mile detour. So we think that's money well spent. So we have two angles on efficiency, but the 15% efficiency is the internal number, and we've got a methodology, which I'm happy to share, as to how we kind of track that. And I have to say, having been on the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors, and I asked my friend, then President David Olson, should I take this job? And he said, yeah, absolutely you should. You know, you'll return my phone call. And I said, well, anybody will return your phone call. But then I said, well, do you have any advice? And he said, get that efficiency study that was done in 2009. And I did that. And we've actually gone farther beyond some of those recommendations like shared services. Now I think MnDOT has deployed some that make sense, others that are not. And we've actually worked with a lot of chamber CEOs over the past year on the three main areas that we're focusing on. We've got good feedback, both from them and some suggestions. So we've been reaching out to the business community to kind of look at ways, the best practices that go beyond just government.
Senator Carlson and members, I'll just call your attention to the time, and we have a full agenda. Senator Carlson. Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll call your attention to the time.
I'm asking this because a bit of a dare. Do you know the difference between sodium chloride, calcium chloride, and magnesium chloride, and when we should be using it on our roads?
Mr. Chair,
this is the true question.
Sadly, you've asked me this before. And then I go back and ask, and then I got to write it down. I know that our materials labs continues to look at the cost benefit of the different mixtures, and I always hear that's great, but it's so expensive, so they pick and choose, and that's kind of what I remember. I know you know the answer much better than me, which is why I know I'll call you if I ever get into that.
Thank you.
We'll have a hearing on the subject.
Thank you.
I have Senator Kiffmeyer and the Senator.
Okay. Well, again, Commissioner, good to see you, and it's nice to know that we've seen you out in just about every district, and that is really a good thing, as others have said as well. And the efficiencies, I think the corridors of commerce have been one of the most successful programs, and especially the fact that I thought it was kind of interesting, puzzled me at first to not be on Minship or STIP or anything like that, and I think it's been so successful. I hope, Commissioner, you stay true to that and hold that, because I think that's going to be the continued success, or will slip into the old ways, as it can be so easily. One quick question. What has been the greatest, you might say, return in regards to an efficiency? You know, where did you go that kind of gave you that biggest return?
Commissioner.
Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I think that early on there was ways to, for instance, the savings we realized in the St. Croix crossing was from looking at the actual footprint of some of the approachways. It could be designed in ways that took less land, less right-of-way than was initially thought. So that actually was a savings, that the design and the performance wasn't compromised. Mm-hmm. We were able to kind of release some funds. I think that going forward, I think that some of the largest impacts, again, are going to be how we manage our pavements and our assets, and when we do refurbishment, when we do full reconstruction over time. And so I think the best efficiencies that I see are going to come over time, not kind of when you've already scoped a project and designed it. Things get pretty well set. I think the best efficiency will be taking these long-term approaches to how we meet the longer-term needs, both how we manage the existing system, now we think about the strategic investments going forward. When you think about some of these larger interchanges, by actually having an innovative design that not only can achieve the mobility standards, but maybe do it for less funds, I think those are fairly big impacts too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's – I was concerned that you had run out of efficiencies, and it's encouraging to know that in what you've done now, but that we can look forward to an ongoing and even greater value. So I appreciate the fact that you kept your focus on the purpose of the roads is to keep people moving, not to stop them, and that sometimes since that is a good investment. So appreciate that. Thank you.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Zelli, two questions. First, I've just concluded several town meetings in my district in the last couple of weeks, and one example came up early in one of my meetings, and I kept bringing it up later on, and found just great reaction from the citizens. And the question is, when we talk efficiencies, has the department looked at recommending or working to revise environmental review processes? And the example that was brought up to me was in southern Minnesota, a road that was being redone, and a government unit, might have been MnDOT, whoever brought it up to me, the story they said was they'd spent $300,000 on environmental review on a road that has been in existence for decades. And the question is, why do we spend money on environmental review of roads that are already there? It's not a new road. It's not a new proposition. And so I'm just raising this issue because I kept bringing it up later meetings. It's another example of efficiency and something where we as a legislature and as a government should take a serious look at. If we're reviewing environmental reviews or doing environmental reviews on roads that have existed for decades, we know the impact. What are your comments and thoughts on that? And is that something MnDOT, under your direction, is willing to look at? And maybe they already have. If you could comment on that, I found it refreshing or interesting how everybody at later meetings when we talk about it just would affirm as that's common sense.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, it absolutely is a cost. Environmental review or a full-blown environmental impact statement process for many of our projects. I don't know the specific one that you may have heard about, and to the extent you identify it, I'm happy to look into it. Generally, it involves a new project or a refurbishment of something that triggers it. I think that for us, it's really for us to follow the law most often with federal funds. It's the NEPA. It's the NEPA law that really dictates a lot of our work. One of the things that we've been working toward with AASHTO and then with the federal partners, Federal Highway, and that they've actually allowed us now to help streamline projects, is to have a preferred alternative when you're thinking through a project, and to simultaneously have the environmental review work done, so we don't have to wait for the whole environmental impact and then go to the next one, which delays projects by years. So I think that is something that we're now pioneering. We're doing that in Highway 53 relocation between Eveleth and Virginia, and there's a big time crunch on that major project. And so I think we're finding ways, if we can, explore ways to make it more efficient. But we are subject to both state or more often federal law that dictates our work. And in that regard, we do work with obviously EPA and MPCA here, but also the Corps of Engineers. How the U.S. defines waterways might actually go right into. We spend a lot of time on water, and so we have hydrologists and others. We think about the water not only in terms of how we design projects, but how we do our snow plowing and our salt work. Today is going to be our biggest snowfall of the year. We're very excited to actually get the trucks out.
Senator Westrum.
So, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Zelli, I appreciate that. And to the extent you could as an agency, I would welcome, and I think many of us would welcome, ideas or suggestions or a cheat sheet, if you will, of things that maybe seem like over or redundant review processes when we've already got roads in existence. It seems to make little sense to spend time and money and resources writing up a report versus a new road. So I share that with you. I think we've seen an open-mindedness from you, and I appreciate that. Secondly, speaking of open-mindedness, I know we've worked and you've taken action to raise the speed limit, and I publicly credit you for that. And I have appreciated seeing the work that MnDOT has been willing to do, and the legislature, of course, passed it last year to do all of the state roads. And so from a rural perspective, I get continued reaffirmations from constituents that like the 60 miles on Highway 59, Highway 75, and the others that are coming. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator. And yes, I didn't know. Who knew I had these powers when I started taking these jobs? I appreciate your comments, and we will certainly look at ways to think about those review processes.
Okay. Senator Centrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. Commissioner Zelli, from my perspective at least, this is a confirmation test or hearing, and you've certainly passed the test. We may not always agree on efficiencies and how much is enough, and we may not always agree on transportation funding and which direction that takes, but I think generally speaking, you've been cordial, you've been out there, you've been a person I think that's grown in this job a lot. It seems to me you were before this committee literally the first day of your working life as a commissioner, and you did very well there, and I think you've continued to grow in this job, and I will certainly support you in your endeavors going forward. Look forward to working with you, and certainly you will have my vote for confirmation.
All right. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you very much, Senator. And I really do. I kind of don't know whose party it is. I'm out working with local elected officials, and I really appreciate the work you do and the support I've gotten.
Commissioner, you have my vote, too. I'll say nice things about you on the floor later, though. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that the Committee on Transportation and Public Safety advise the full Senate to consent to and confirm the appointment of Charles Zelli as Commissioner of the Department of Transportation.
To the amendment, members, questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Commissioners.
Members, let's move to Senate File 86. And I'll take it from the table. And I think we were last on an amendment. Amendment 815, which is in your packet. Is that correct? Should be still in your packet. Yes, it's well, mine is. Hopefully, yours is too. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd ask for a roll call vote, please.
All right, a roll call vote has been requested. A roll call vote will be granted.
And I'd also, Mr. Chair, like the page to hand out. There's a document that provides some additional information from the National Conference of State Legislators. And I'd highlight the back half of the page regarding automatic license plate readers. Just a piece of information that might be helpful in making people's decisions.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Whose amendment is this?
This is Senator Osmick's amendment.
Did he move it then?
He had moved it. Does he need to move it again?
I wasn't here at the prior hearing.
He moved it at the prior hearing.
So the amendment is still before us? Is that the way the
process
is?
I'm asking that, Senator Rest. Is the amendment still before us?
I believe it's still before us.
Well, Senator Osmick, why don't you move the amendment
again? I will move the A15 amendment.
All right, the A15 amendment has been moved. All right. Anything further, members? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, in our previous hearing, there was a fair amount of question to the State Patrol in regard to a specific time frame that the State Patrol keeps it. It's 48 hours, and I see today we got a four-page handout on that issue. My sense was, after hearing some of the other testimony, that the police work done by the State Patrol and our local law enforcement has some very significant differences. Do you have somebody that could maybe address that issue, what the differences local law enforcement, the job they do, and why they might need a longer time compared to the State Patrol and the 48 hours that they have?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Peterson. You will note in the State Patrol's handout that they identify some of the stuff that they specifically focus on as their priorities, traffic enforcement primarily. And that accounts for their shorter retention period. But local law enforcement is involved in ongoing investigations of all the range of criminal conduct that occurs in society. And often motor vehicles are either involved in one way or another with that conduct, or the perpetrators utilize motor vehicles at some point, and it helps to be able to track them down. So identifying them and tracking them down are important, and that ranges everywhere from, you know, not just the Amber Alerts that are listed here, but we heard the testimony in the previous hearing about Bloomington and trying to find the person that threw the vise off of a bridge that landed, you know, and took out a gentleman's jaw. That was a retention period of 64 days before they were able to identify and catch the suspect. You had the murder of Officer Scott Patrick from Mendota Heights, in which Mr. Fitch was found with the help of LPR data that was retained beyond the day then that the data was obtained. In Duluth, the abduction of the 13-year-old child was solved in part with historical LPR data. The drive-by shooting in St. Paul, where they used data that was 32 days old to help solve that and to eliminate two of the three suspects and focus in on the one suspect. So it had the effect of exonerating two people and identifying the third person that had, in fact, committed the crime. To your point also, Senator Peterson, and apropos of this amendment that's before the committee, and the NCSL legislative brief that has been handed out, if you look on the back of that page, it identifies states with statutes that regulate license plate readers. Well, we have gone through and looked up these statutes, and you also have in your packet then a handout from me which summarizes the retention period for each of those states. And you will see that none of those states have a zero retention period, not one of them. Now, they have retention periods that vary quite a bit. Some of them, 18 months, 1 year, in the case of Colorado, no destruction date in Florida whatsoever. The shortest one looks to me like it is 21 days. And that's in Maine. So I think the because this question was also asked at the last hearing, you know, what are other states doing? Well, this is what other states are doing, members. And so I would submit to you that there is some value to considering that as well. Before you get to a vote, Mr. Chairman, on this amendment, I do have a few other words I'd like to say, but not specifically in response to Senator Peterson's question.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, that was my sense after the testimony in our previous hearing that that there was a significant difference in the work that's done by the State Patrol and our local law enforcement. And I think Senator Latz, you very clearly stated that from my perspective, you know, I will not be supporting this amendment for that reason, and I appreciate the 90 days appears to me already to be a significant concession from what it has been. And I would urge members to go slow and try this reduction to 90 days, and we can revisit this again as soon as next legislative session if it does not appear to be working and causes problems. So I would urge you to vote against the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Right. Senator, I think Senator Newman is next, and then Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, I've had the pleasure of seeing this bill now for the third time. I sit on the Judiciary Committee and the Rules Committee.
I'm on the Transportation Committee.
And insofar as this particular amendment is concerned, I want to raise two points. I was quite concerned with this bill coming to the Transportation Committee, knowing full well that data retention is really the issue that was being debated. And I was concerned about it because of the jurisdictional issue. You know, does this committee have the authority to even entertain this amendment? And the conclusion that I came to after listening to the discussion of the Rules Committee is that once the Rules Committee transfers this bill, refers this bill to the committee, I took a look at Mason's, and I took a look at the rules of the Senate, and And frankly, I think that once the Rules Committee transfers jurisdiction to this committee has the jurisdiction to do with this bill whatever it to do. And frankly, the data retention issue is destined to be fought out on the Senate floor no matter what. So I am now comfortable that we have the ability to entertain this amendment. As far as the amendment itself is concerned, two reasons, or two lines as to why I support the amendment, although I do strongly support the notion of having these automated license procedures as a wonderful law enforcement tool. First of all, the rationale as to why we are going to allow data retention. When I look at it, we are retaining private data on individuals who have who are not under investigation by law enforcement. They literally have not been alleged of any type of wrongdoing. And secondly, they haven't consented to the retention of that data. And I think that those two points are critical in entertaining the idea of whether we're going to allow data retention or not. The idea that we're going to retain it for, say, 90 days rather than 180 days is really a compromise based on no foundation. If you take my logic to its ultimate conclusion, if we're going to allow law enforcement to retain private data where no consent has been given, and the person who is the subject of that private data hasn't done anything wrong, then I would see no reason in allowing law enforcement to retain this data forever as long as they want it to use it, because the reason they want to retain it is because it's going to help solve crimes in the future. And I think Senator Latch has made a very good presentation in support of that argument. So the first thing I'm saying is that no consent, no wrongdoing. I don't see any reason or basis to allow law enforcement to retain our private data. The other thing that I want to bring to your attention, and I did mention this in the Judiciary Committee, is that we are asking law enforcement to make promises. And Senator Latz has done a very good job in putting into this bill protections and safety measures so that our private data is going to be, in fact, protected. The problem is that we are asking law enforcement to make a promise that I don't think they can keep. And I think they're going to try. I think they're going to do their absolute best. But it doesn't take too long to just do a quick internet search on what happens to our private information. And there are two sources of a problem. One is external hacking. And I would draw your attention to the Target problem that arose not too long ago. There was a hacker that broke into the healthcare.gov website. Banks have been hacked. Sony Pictures was hacked. Very recently, Anthem was hacked. And so we've got external hacking that's going on, despite the best efforts of our government to protect our data. The other is internal misuse of the data, and that is probably more widespread than the hacking, where you have folks on the inside that have access to the data and use it for illegal purposes. Granted, there are provisions in this bill to provide for punishment, but that doesn't mean it isn't going to happen. There are numerous, and I mean numerous, instances within law enforcement, within Metro Transit, within the DNR, Division of Licenses for Public Safety, where improper use by employees that have access to it have misused it. So my point is, I'm not so sure that law enforcement is going to be able to make this promise that I think that they genuinely want
to keep. We have seen this automated license plate reader bill. We are going to see a bill, I think, on police and body cams. We have got surveillance cameras out there that are taking pictures of us. I know originally Senator Latz had a provision in this bill regarding drones. That has been deleted, and I suspect maybe he wants to have a further discussion on that in the future. But my point is this. We are attacking this data retention issue on a piecemeal basis. And I question the wisdom of that when we know that we're going to have data retention issues with respect to body cams, automated license plate readers, drones, surveillance cameras. It's going to come at us from multiple directions. I passed out a letter from the Legislative Commission on Data Practices. I think there's a typo, January 8th. I think that's probably should be 2015 rather than 14, but I'm not sure about that. But I want to draw your attention. You know, we have put together a Legislative Commission on Data Practices, and that's a group of folks that got together on a bipartisan basis and discussed this issue. And I want to bring your attention to the bottom bullet point on this letter of the first page. No retention of any data gathered by automated license plate readers that is not HIT data or active investigative data. Now, that's what our colleagues that spent a lot of time on this legislative commission, their thoughts are and what they came up with in terms of a recommendation. So, in conclusion, members, my final position on this amendment and this bill is I think the bill is a good idea, but I think we ought to attack this data retention issue from a much larger standpoint than just the piecemeal basis of these individual bills that go forward. And I would envision that we would see a law in Minnesota that says this data is private and cannot be retained except in the following instances in accordance with the following criteria, and then we would list the criteria telling law enforcement when they can retain it. Senator Latz has brought up a good point. There's a lot of states, including Florida, he said, with no limit on retention. So I know it's a law enforcement tool, but with no consent and no allegation of wrongdoing, I think we should have a much larger conversation on data retention. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman, I think that was a campaign speech for the Commission on Data Practices. All right. Thank you. Senator Latz, do you want to respond? I don't think there's a question in there.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, my understanding is that the Legislative Commission on Data Practices was populated with at least five of the eight members who have stated a public position on this particular issue as zero retention before the commission even started meeting. And my understanding is that there was one no vote, as Senator Kent has already acknowledged at the last hearing. It was her, and that there was one member missing at the time of the vote on this who I believe also to have been opposed to the position that was adopted by the commission.
I wasn't there. For the record, my view on the subject is an evolving view, so I don't know if you're counting me in that five
Pardon
or
me?
Not. So for the record, my view is an evolving view on the subject as I've had more time with the issue, and so I don't know if you're counting me in that five or not, but I've been open and available to the debate as it's wound its way through the process.
Well, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. And I don't have personal knowledge of the positions of everyone on the commission before or after they were appointed to the commission. So it was a generalized statement. Secondly, with regard to the issue of internal misuse that Senator Newman raised, basically the suggestion that law enforcement might inappropriately and without permission access the databases to which they have access for a purpose that they're not authorized to do. Frankly, there's a lot more sensitive data that the government holds that ought to be a concern of unauthorized access, not just pictures of your driver's license data either. I mean, there's a ton of data in the Department of Human Services, for example, that lots of folks have access to. and a lot more sensitive, I would submit, than the location of a person who is out driving on our public streets, who technically that location isn't ever private information because they are out in the public streets of their own volition. This bill makes it private for a limited period of time to enable investigations to take place when that data becomes relevant to a criminal investigation. I agree with Senator Newman that there's some problems dealing with this issue sort of on a piecemeal basis in the bigger picture of data practices. There was a bill last year that dealt with a little broader concept that has not been reintroduced yet this year. It wasn't my bill, but the chief author in the Senate opted not to introduce it so far this year. But the fact is the Data Practices Act is filled with individualized treatment of different questions, different kinds of data. Some data, there are two major classifications, but within each classification there are a number of subcategories, and then you pick your data and it fits into one of the multiple categories. So we already do that kind of on a piecemeal basis. We are on a new threshold of what to do with sort of the automated aspect of collecting certain kinds of data, and that's what this bill is specifically about. But the fact is right now, law enforcement has the right, and they regularly do, obtain license plate information as they are driving around in their squad cars, and they run that information through multiple databases, looking for sex offenders, looking for immigration violations, looking for violations of orders for protection, Amber Alerts, missing persons, as well as drivers after cancellation, and that's just a list from the State Patrol. So we have the capacity now to collect more of this data and to be able to utilize it for law enforcement investigations much more effectively to protect the public. What this bill does is attempts to strike a balance between those public safety advances and concerns people have about their location being gathered into an electronic database for any period or even a limited period of time. So that's in response to Senator Newman's comments. I'll leave it at that for the moment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Rest and Senator Reiner.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mine is just a procedural point. I really appreciated that Senator Newman had the copy of the letter withdrawn and then redistributed with his name on it, and that Senator Osmet did the same with not withdrawn, but with a brief from the NCSL. But the even though I'm assuming that the document coming from the DPS Minnesota State Patrol is being offered to us by Senator Latz, as well as the additional thing on the retention period, I just encourage people to sign your name on something if you're going to hand it out in the committee, so that committee members, just like on the floor, we don't hand out things regardless of the source without identifying who actually is putting forward the document. So I just make that request, and I'm just assuming that this one is coming from Senator Latz.
No,
or if it's
State
not,
Patrol provided to the committee, as I understand.
Okay, so we would need to know who things are actually coming from as they
point well taken. Thank you, Senator.
As they come forward.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Reiner.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass until we're on the actual bill.
Okay, thank you. Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Whoop.
It was a question before Osmond. Oh, I apologize, Senator Osmond. I wasn't keeping track of my list here. If you don't mind, I have Senator Westrom, then Senator Peterson, then Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, Senator Osmond, I'll ask you this question, and maybe it's one Senator Latz instead, but on one of the lists, I think it's the NCSL one you handed out, it's talking about a couple states that have data as private, no retention period. What does that mean versus the other states that have 21 days, 24 days, or you name it, or what this bill will do. Do you know the distinction or the difference? Otherwise, Senator Latz maybe does.
Senator, your question is to Senator Osmick.
Well, it is. I assume that's your sheet that you handed out, the NCSL one.
Senator Osmick handed out the NCSL sheet. Senator Latz handed out the sheet that had further clarification of some of the data in the NCSL sheet.
Mr. Chair, I'm referring to the NCSL with the list of states and dates, time periods, and specifically they've got Florida and Maryland listed as data is private, no period.
So that would be
Senator
no prescribed destruction date. What's that? And I'm just trying to figure out what the distinction is of data as private versus the others for 21 days or 24 days or 180 days. So I don't know if Senator Osmick, you have a comment on that, or Senator Latz. I'd just like to,
Mr. Chair,
know if there's a distinction here.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Westrom's point, we had research take a look at it, and actually the legislation in those particular two states appears to be silent as far as the destruction date. So in theory, the reason why Senator Latz would have said no prescribed destruction date is because there isn't anything prescribed. So in theory, they can hold the data forever, but the data is quote-unquote private, which would keep it out of public access, that you wouldn't be able to have a public data request. That's my interpretation.
So Mr.
Senator Westrom.
Chair, to this amendment and to that point, Senator Latz, what is the difference between that and those states and your bill? Is the information for 90 days still held private here or public? Can you give us that distinction?
Sure. Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Westrom, right now, if we do nothing, once the temporary classification from the Minnesota Department of Administration expires, I believe July 31st of this year, all of the data that is gathered is public. And by default, the data that's gathered by law enforcement of this nature, government data without any other classification, is public data. This bill affirmatively classifies that data as private and then limits the period of retention of that data to 90 days, after which the data must be destroyed.
All right. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just reviewing this letter here, I see that you signed the letter as co-chair of the Legislative Commission on Data Practices. And then the last public record that I can find for a meeting was on December 22nd of 2014. Does that sound about right if this letter's dated January 8th?
Yes. So I think the action... Where is the letter? So the action was taken on December 15th, 2014. And the reason for the delay and the date should be January 8th, 2015. The reason for the delay in the date is we were trying to get the signature of my co-chair, who was State Representative Holberg, and we just couldn't get a hold of her, so we decided to go ahead and we were going to send the letter out earlier, and we just, by that time, she got busy with her new duties at Dakota County. So,
okay,
over
so
the holidays, we just didn't get her attention, get her signature.
So. Okay, so Mr. Chair, I have not reviewed the agenda for. You said December 15th was the date you took action.
Yeah, that's in the body of the letter.
Yep. Okay, so then the question I have, Mr. Chair, for the commission, were you taking testimony at that time? From law enforcement and the State Patrol in regards to this issue, or in that meeting on December 15th, like you said,
Senator Peterson, I don't think we did. I think the proposed language had been circulated earlier by Representative Lesch. There was some debate and discussion on this particular letter, and Senator Kent can help me remember if we had testimony or not.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. I don't believe we did have testimony on that date in December. We had an earlier hearing that was much more dedicated to this particular issue, and we had a wide range of testimony. I don't have that date on me, but
right.
We can get it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Osbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Letts, I guess I've got I have a little confusion on New Hampshire. You have an indication here that it's 24 days up to 18 months if used at trial. I'm looking at some recent reports, one here, a web report as of the 6th of February of this year, saying, and the headline is, New Hampshire is the only state to ban automatic license plate readers for now. So I'm not quite certain if that what you have here is accurate, particularly when I'm seeing it specifically reported, although, you know, the World Wide Web could be wrong. I do have concerns about that. And the other question I have for you is on page 3, lines 7 through 9. I've got a lot of concerns about this data. Once it leaves Minnesota's jurisdiction, say it be to the Department of Homeland Security, FBI, NSA, any group that we would obviously not have jurisdictional control over, nor would be able to prove whether they followed our requirements of 90-day destruction. I'm assuming that lines 3.7 through 3.9 are the ones you're referring to, saying that gives the jurisdictional authority to provide that information to agencies if they request it. Is that correct?
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, I'll answer the first question first. With regard to New Hampshire, and I'll take the information off of the NCSL sheet that Senator Osmek distributed. On the bottom of page 2, it says that New Hampshire is among the states that restrict government or law enforcement use of the license plate readers. The next paragraph says that New Hampshire also prohibits private use of the license plate readers. But apparently the use by law enforcement is allowed, but subject to the restrictions that they have in their statute. And this is just the data taken from the NCSL. With regard to the sharing of data with other agencies, it would be illegal for any Minnesota agency subject to this statute to share the data that is obtained with the license plate readers with any other law enforcement agency that does not itself comply with the requirements of this bill. So my understanding is that even the federal agencies are moving expeditiously, the FBI in particular, toward a 90-day retention period as a matter of policy, but that they have not reached that conclusion yet. But this only would apply to sharing the underlying data itself. If the FBI, for example, I think were to say we're looking for information on a particular license plate that we think was involved in a crime that we're investigating, and ask a local law enforcement agency that had the database to run a query on that, then it would be a different question. If they had a hit, they'd have investigative data. It would be subject to a different classification than what's here. It would not be sending the law enforcement database from the agency that collected it off to a federal agency, for example, for whatever purposes they want to use. Not the broad, unfiltered data.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that, but you will admit that once they receive that data, let's say, for example, the FBI, that we, if they decide not to, first off, we're probably not here in Minnesota going to find out that they have not destroyed the data, and we would also have no recourse against them to deal with that because we don't have jurisdictional control over the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osmek, you're kind of asking a federal court's question in part here, which is a bit beyond, frankly, my own knowledge as to what enforcement authority or what law, legal action the state of Minnesota could take against a federal agency that violated the terms and conditions of the release of data to that federal agency. I suspect that if it were ever determined that they violated it, and they just said, you know, we don't care, you can't enforce it against us, might be the last time that a state agency would ever share the data with them, because then the state agency would be affirmatively violating this statute by doing so, not only having the trust destroyed. So I would think it would not be in a federal agency's long-term best interest to violate the trust and the arrangements that they have with local law enforcement agencies, on whom they often depend for assistance in solving crimes.
All right. All right, so anything further, members? Okay, a roll call has been requested.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
I did ask for an opportunity to make a couple of closing remarks before the vote on the amendment, if I may.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, some questions were raised at the last hearing with regard to whether or not the technology could be upgraded to allow for facial recognition or other kind of advanced technologies. I wanted to note that that is not something that is contemplated within this bill. Lines 3.12 to 0.15 provide that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension must be notified if there is any such technological upgrades. So it would not be hidden from public view, and there would be an ample opportunity for public discussion and action by this legislature if there were an effort to upgrade that technology in that way. Also, Senator Westrom had asked a series of questions as we concluded the hearing last Wednesday, including, for example, what is the lawful basis for a stop of a motor vehicle. I just want to note for the committee's consideration that while they are valuable and interesting questions, they did not go to the question of should the retention period be 0 days or 90 days or 180 days or anything else. Those questions were all relevant for really the contemplation of whether or not we ought to use or allow the use of license plate reader data at all, including hit data, the instant that the data is obtained. So I ask members to consider that. Also, Professor Olson made some remarks with regard to concern about law enforcement sitting at, for example, gun shows or conventions, running plates and so on, and then building a database of attendees at those events. That would not be a permissible use under current law, as far as I'm aware. It's certainly not allowed under this bill. This bill would only allow for data to be queried in connection with a specific criminal investigation. That's among the many guardrails that have been placed around this bill, the 9 amendments that were added in the Judiciary Committee relating to this. Members, this bill attempts to strike a balance between the important and valuable public safety technique of retaining license plate reader data for a limited period of time to assist law enforcement in solving some heinous crimes as well as more routine crimes, and recognizing persons' concerns about the retention of data on their actual locations at any given time. I think that the bill you have before you strikes that balance appropriately, and the amendment that you have before you would have made it much, much harder, if not impossible in some cases, to solve some of the crimes that you heard law enforcement testify last Wednesday were solved with the assistance of historical or retained license plate data. I'd urge you to vote no on this amendment so that data can still be used to solve crimes.
Thank you. Senator Sundrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, could you look at the last the last few words of Senator Osmond's amendment? And basically the amendment says all this data should not be retained unless. And then it goes, or the data are active investigative data. It would seem to me, going even to that example of the FBI, that if there was a case under investigation, that data would be retained or could be retained and used in conjunction with a license plate reader. I don't think this amendment necessarily shuts this data down altogether in every case. Would you agree with that?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sundrum, no, I would not agree with that, because the limitations that are contained in here, including that last phrase, the data are active investigative data, the only way to know is someone's license plate location, as it's captured as active investigative data, is if it's already on a hit list. If it's already on a list of known license plates that are involved in a crime that the police already know is under investigation.
Right.
It's easier to capture them, but you don't need a retention period for that. If, however, you don't know on day zero that a license plate or the registered owner of the driver of that vehicle is part of a crime or was involved in a crime, that data is destroyed immediately. Even if you find out the next day that it was a case, you know, that there was a murder, and a witness comes forward a day after the LPR data is obtained and destroyed and says, you know, I saw a partial plate, and it was a white Camry starting with the license plate letters ABC. And the police say, great, now we've got some idea. Maybe we can find out who that vehicle was owned by and where that vehicle is now. Oops, the data's gone because it was destroyed because there was no retention whatsoever, not even for a day, not even for 2 days. So if you've got an Amber Alert, every minute counts. You might be 5 minutes too late to save the life of a three-year-old child that was abducted. Or by then, that child may be in the abducting parent's car, the estranged parent's car, already across the Mexico border. So that's why it's so important at least to have some retention period. Now, is 90 days the magic number? I don't know. At some point, the utility of retaining the data is overcome by our sensibilities of the privacy interests as they're being described. But some retention period, I would submit to this body, is important for those reasons. The amendment that you have before you mandates destruction the same day that the data is obtained. In fact, one might say if it's not found on a hit list instantly, it has to be destroyed instantly. It might even be an hour later that you get a witness comes forward and says, yeah, I saw the license plate for the crime that was involved in the shooting of that police officer. The data's already gone. That's why you need some retention period, Senator Senjum.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Anything further? All right. Roll.
On the A15 amendment, Senator Carlson.
No.
Senator Champion.
Pass.
Senator Franzen.
No.
Senator Jensen.
No.
Senator Kent.
No.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes.
Senator Newman.
Yes.
Senator Osmek.
Yes.
Senator Peterson.
No.
Senator Pratt.
Yes.
Senator Reinert.
No.
Senator Rest.
No.
Senator Senjum.
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni.
Yes.
Senator Westrum.
Yes.
Senator Weger.
No.
And Chairman Dibble.
Yes.
Senator Champion.
It's a tiebreak.
I'm going with the chair. With Chair Latz. So no.
Okay.
No. Okay. 8 in favor, 9 against.
Senator, Mr. Chair. On a vote of 8 yeses and 9 noes, the motion does not prevail. Anything further?
I'm sorry. Chair. I was going with Chair Latz. Yeah, so
that's correct.
Oh, it's okay.
You did
it. I just want to make sure.
All right.
Okay.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
So, anything further, members? Senator Weston.
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment I think Council's got, just dealing briefly with the databases.
All right.
I believe Chairman Latz, they were going to try to get you a copy of it earlier. If you want to hand it out real quick, I'll try to make it real fast, Mr. Chair.
At the A18, Senator Weston?
I believe so. Council can probably affirm that.
Yes, it is the A18.
Is that right? And basically, Mr. Chair, what it does is it just says that they have to make a, they have to provide a list of what databases we are comparing it against, state or federal. I hope we can find ways to tighten this up a little bit more. Obviously, we spent a lot of time on the 0 or 90 days, and maybe we haven't hit the magic number yet, but. We heard testimony last week, and I think it would be prudent to know what databases we are comparing against. I would ask for your support.
Great. Thank you. Senator Latz.
seen this? Do you have a...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I appreciate Senator Westrom sharing the amendment with us ahead of time. It was very helpful. In general, I think it's a friendly amendment. I think it's a helpful amendment. It assists with transparency in this process. The only concern that I have is that in the event one of the databases is, for some reason that we don't anticipate right now, already a not public database, including the existence of which may not be generally known to the public for some security reason or whatever the reason may be, I wouldn't want this log to put an agency in the position of either complying with state law or disclosing some kind of the existence of a database that for national security reasons or whatever may not be publicly known. So I would ask if the author would consider at the end of the line 3, after the word compared, insert words to the effect of, and I was drafting this on the fly and maybe counsel would have a better idea of this, unless the existence of the database itself is not public.
Mr. Chair, if counsel has any comment on it, I have two thoughts. One, that could be a friendly amendment to the amendment. I would be interested in maybe just a little input from some in the public that have thoughts on this. Or secondly, Chairman Latz, would take my amendment, put it on, and I would certainly work with you on this language if there's such a thing and there's a better way to finesse it. You as the author certainly have control over the bill, but either way, I think we could achieve a similar end. So,
appropriately, not complete control over the bill, Senator Westrom.
So either way, I think we're...
So, Senator Westrom...
What does counsel think of that oral amendment? And
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, I think that, you know, it fits. I think it works for what Senator Latz's concern is. And as far as I'm concerned, it would give the Judiciary Council an opportunity to react to it at a later date. Anyway,
sure.
She's really been the one working on these amendments.
Okay. So if you'd...
Senator Westrom, this will land back in the Senator Latz's finance division. So.
Sure. Okay. And those interested can comment there as well. And so, Mr. Chair, I would propose my amendment as orally amended.
So, members, the amendment would read page 2, line 18, before the semicolon, insert, quote, and a list of all state and federal databases with which data that were collected were compared unless the existence of the database itself is not public. Any questions? Favor say aye.
Mr. Chair.
Aye.
Oh, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, I guess in support of the A18, I guess my question would be if we're not going to share data with those who don't comply with our rules as we've set out here, and we don't have a list of those databases where our data is being bumped up against, how are we expected to audit or ensure that we're able to follow the criteria under item 2 on page 2.
Mr. Latz.
Mr. Chairman, line 2.25 of the bill provides that the data in the log required under the paragraph are public. So if we were to have an audit that could review all of the databases, including, for example, because federal databases are listed in the A18 amendment, if there is some kind of a database that has requires security clearance or is a secret for national security purposes, but there's a query that's made of it, obviously disclosing the existence of that database could compromise national security, and then it would become public under the terms of the underlying bill here. So if there were some way to allow for that information to be retained but remain private and not violate federal law, but still subject to at least some kind of audit review, I'm okay with that. I can't craft that language here sitting at the table, and I think we probably would need a little more input from Judiciary Council on that question and maybe some others on how to do that. I don't object to the notion of maintaining and identifying some of that information for purposes of oversight, but I am concerned that there may be a database that we don't want to put in a public data log part of an audit. I would expect they'd be few and far between. I think, you know, most of the databases that would be involved here are already well-known, like the motor vehicle registration database, the driver's license database, those kind of things.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Senator Latz. I appreciate you pointing out that section. I'm just still stuck on between, I guess, line 210, you know, effectively through 215. Where it says that you know, they must comply with our data destruction requirements. If we don't know where that data is being used, and they don't have to provide us that information when they obtain the data, that concerns me. That then we've, to Senator Osmick's point earlier, that we've lost control. I think second, I'll just leave it at that.
All right. On the A18, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion. I'm sorry, the A18 as amended, so that was clear. All right. We'll make sure it's reflected in the minutes. Senator Latz, I'll just flag an issue. I know this is kind of on its way back to committee, the subdivision under your jurisdiction. I didn't have a chance to share with you of alternative amendments, so I'd like some opportunity to discuss those with you at some point along the way. And that has to do with the testimony of the BCA at our last hearing, in which they were concerned that they were tasked with determining the location of stationary license plate readers, making the determination whether or not that reader, the location of that reader, constitutes security information as defined in Section 13.37. So we need to kind of work that out, you know, what exactly the issue is with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, what this particular section, what problem this particular section is trying to solve, and also the fact
I share your concerns on that, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to talk with you about it.
Also, reconciling the language on line 2.23 that says that stationary locations are basically public information subject to you know, mention in a public log. So we'll have more conversation about that in the future. Senator Sindrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Latz, I have one too that maybe you can just take a look at, it may need some massaging. You can decide, but it would seem to me that an automatic license plate reader, being an electronic device, could be in a stationary location. That's an option. It could take a photograph. And what I'm leading to is many, many, many cameras that might be on off a Walmart store, off the state capitol, off all kinds of private entities, although the state capitol being obviously not private, but a lot of private cameras out there could, if they were used in conjunction with an investigation with law enforcement. That data then, it seems to me, per the wording of the bill, becomes, if you will, private data. And then how does the private company deal with then private data in their own camera system? You don't have to answer it today, but think about it as you read the bill, because I read it repeatedly, and if that's your intent, that's your intent. But I'm not sure that's probably the case, and maybe an unforeseen kind of circumstance that just exists within the language of the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Senator Senjum, this bill deals only with government data, because that's the only data that we have the power, frankly, to declare to be private or to classify something other than its default position as government data being public. What you're referring to is data that is obtained, collected by a private entity.
Right.
This bill has nothing to do with that, except to the extent that that data is then shared with a law enforcement agency. And that's covered on lines 1.14 to 1.16. And then, to the extent it's shared with the law enforcement agency, then it takes on the data classification that's described in the bill.
And Mr. Chair, and
Senator Central.
And I think we're tracking at that point. Then my question would be, how does the individual business company, et cetera, how do they deal with then the data that they have? They've shared it, but they still have it. Is that private data at that point? It's a nuance, I understand, but all of this is real, and that question is going to come up at some point if this bill goes forward.
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer to the question is that the data that the private entity collects remains their data, but unless and only to the extent, and this is language off line 1.15, to the extent the data collected by the reader is shared with a law enforcement agency, then it gets covered by this bill. But if they don't share it, or even after they share it, whatever they've still retained is still theirs. The data that's been shared has been transferred electronically into the possession of the law enforcement agency, then it's covered by this bill. Assuming the private organization retains a copy of the data, it's theirs to do with what they wish. It would be the subject for another discussion, another legislation perhaps, but it's not the subject of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right. So anything further, members? So Senator Kent moves Senate File 86 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Any questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Thank you, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and
members. That's the we're not going to get to the other bills, so we will be adjourned for the day.